Welcome to Side Streets, a podcast about the history and geography of London. I'm Alan Hertz, Professor Emeritus of Humanities at Hult International Business School. Despite my accent, I've been prowling London and learning about its past for over 40 years. Side Streets is a Black Lab media production, and my producer and editor is Wilhelm Schenk. One afternoon, 15 or so years ago, I was lugging a pair of heavy shopping bags down the quadrant, Richmond's Main Street, from Waitrose. As I approached the railroad station, I had a strange, almost supernatural experience. Coming toward me on the narrow pavement was someone who looked a great deal like me. Like me, he was short, a bit plump, a bit bald. Like me, he had a stubbly, graying beard. Like me, he was weighed down by two shopping bags. I had the strange sensation that I was walking toward myself, a feeling made more intense because I recognized him, but could not immediately place him. A former colleague? An actor? My doppelganger? We did that little pavement dance, trying to avoid a collision, but each swerving in the wrong direction until we almost bumped pot bellies. With mild, very English embarrassment, we edged past each other, and I went on my way trying to figure out who on earth I had inconvenienced. Only as I stuck my key in the lock of my front door did I realize that I had just almost met Pete Townsend. He no longer lives in Richmond, alas, but this episode is about how that encounter, or something like it, would have been commonplace, maybe almost inevitable, during the golden age of British rock music in the 1960s. I owe a great debt to three sources. Andrew Humphreys' book, Raving Upon Thames, which manages to be thoughtful, authoritative, and hilarious, often all at the same time. Amanda Franquette's timeline on the Crawdaddy Club website, which is full of glorious stories told beautifully. And the Eel Pie Island Museum, an Aladdin's cave of magnificent sounds, powerful images, and memorabilia to treasure. We should begin on the Twickenham Riverside, where a chain ferry took generations of partygoers across a channel of the Thames to the Eel Pie Hotel on Eel Pie Island. There they could feast on the dubious delicacy that gave the place its name, but more to the point, they could dance to live music in a ballroom. In the 1950s, the hotel was decrepit, the music dated, the clientele dwindling away. The owner, Michael Snapper, who with his pet bear, performing dog, and collection of vintage cars deserves an episode of his own, allowed an employee, Arthur Chisnell, to target a new audience by booking jazz groups. Snapper also built a footbridge, essential not just for customer convenience, but for modern musicians to get their heavy electrical equipment to the hotel. Eel Pie Island became a magnet for young people interested in traditional jazz, then in skiffle, then in ska. Ken Collier ran the house band, and other performers included Acker Bilk, Lonnie Donegan, and other big names of what was, for a brief moment, a very cool style of music. Chisnell, incidentally, had no particular love for any music. His interest was in a new social phenomenon, the teenager. For him, the island was primarily a place of refuge for alienated young people. As blues and R&B became popular, they slipped into the mix. And by the early 1960s, Eel Pieland, as it was rebranded, was drawing fans of Black American music from all over London. Not only that, it was an incubator of a British musical revolution. The Rolling Stones had a slot every Sunday for 6 months in 1963. In the same year, the Yardbirds got their name backstage in a brainstorming session before their first gig. Long John Baldry discovered Rod Stewart playing the harmonica on a platform of Twickenham train station after a night on the island. And Eel Pieland wasn't just a sanctuary for troubled youth or even a proving ground for guitarists and singers who would eventually become great British institutions. Eel Pieland was on the performance itinerary of every American bluesman touring Europe. And that allowed those apprentice superstars to see and hear their idols live rather than just on records. They even got to share the stage. B.B. King, Buddy Guy, John Lee Hooker all played the island, backed by local bands. The harmonies were not always perfect, apparently. According to Sonny Boy Williamson, these British boys want to play the blues so badly, and they do play it badly. Who'd just been backing him? The Yardbirds, with Eric Clapton on guitar. They did record a live album together, however, so maybe the British boys were fast learners. As the fashion for British blues faded in the mid-1960s, the music played at Yelp Island changed. The Muddy Island became very rocky indeed. Eric Clapton is a perfect example of the transformation. He left the Yardbirds in 1964 because they were not bluesy enough and joined John Mayall's ferociously authentic Blues Breakers. 2 years later, he was back on the island with Cream, a hard rock trio a month after it formed. Jack Bruce and Ginger Baker, the rest of the group, had made a similar stylistic migration from one of the island's most popular blues groups, the Graham Bond Organization. That story was repeated again and again. Ray Davis, Jimmy Page, Van Morrison, David Bowie all performed there as members of blues groups only the nerdiest fans have heard of. All, of course, went on to become superstars in different genres. Despite the changing taste, the island continued to be a vital incubator for new music. Pink Floyd first performed there in 1967, so early in their career that they were billed as the Pink Floyd. The Who showcased bits of Tommy in 1968. Here's how Alan Winter, a member of the audience, describes that moment. I remember Pete Townsend saying, "For you locals who've seen me burning the midnight oil with the lights on over the road where I live, I'm working on this new thing, which I call a rock opera. I'm going to play a little bit of it, and I want you to tell us what you think." According to Winter, he was happy to give feedback, shouting at the end of the set, "Stick to your 3-minute singles, mate." Yelp Island had a long run. 14 years from trad jazz to glam rock, but it eventually went up in smoke. The hotel became increasingly dilapidated, the music increasingly loud, and the audience increasingly disorderly. The upstairs rooms became a commune with the acquiescence of Chiswell. But there was no heat, and the residents dismantled wooden parts of the building for fuel. Licensing authorities, the local fire department, and the police paid more and more frequent visits. During one inspection in October 1970, they found the lights fused and 4 out of 5 fire doors chained shut. The membership lists of what was legally a private club were not available. Unaffordable fines followed. The last concert was in November. The next year, while the hotel was being demolished, it caught fire and burnt to the ground. There's now a block of flats on the site. It's worth returning to that moment in 1963 when Acker Bilk gave way to Mick Jagger because another extraordinary local institution and another wild character were responsible for the change. Giorgio Gomelski arrived in Richmond by a very indirect route. He was born in Tbilisi, Georgia in 1934, grew up a refugee from Stalinism in Switzerland, opened a coffee bar in Chelsea in 1955, and was helping out at the Marquee, the great Soho music club, in the early 1960s. There he discovered rhythm and blues, met Brian Jones, a founding member of the Rolling Stones, and fell out with the management. Fancying himself an impresario but blackballed in Soho, he found the half-abandoned back room of a seedy Richmond pub decorated with murals of palm trees and beach houses and opened the Crawdaddy Club. On the 24th of February 1963, the Rolling Stones, then completely unknown, played their first show there and apparently their first show with Charlie Watts and Bill Wyman. They quickly became the house band and almost as quickly became stars, with singles soaring through the charts and crowds waiting at the door. In April, the local paper noticed the phenomenon. A musical magnet is drawing the jazz beatniks away from Yelp Island to a new mecca in Richmond. Its description of the scene is worth repeating. Save for the swaying forms of the group on the spotlit stage, the room is in darkness. A patch of light from the entrance doors catches the sweating dancers and those who are slumped on the floor. A day or two later, the club and the group were certified cool and sanctified forever. Thanks to Gabelski's energetic networking, the Beatles turned up. They met the Stones for the first time and ended up jamming with them in Mick Jagger's flat. By the end of April, the Stones had a weekly gig at Eel Pie Island and more work than they could handle. By June, the Crawdaddy Club had outgrown the back room at the Station Hotel and had moved to the wide open spaces of the Richmond Athletic Ground, home to two rugby teams, and every August to the National Jazz Festival. We'll come back to that in a couple of minutes. By September, the Stones were popular enough for a national tour, and they were replaced at the Crawdaddy Club by the Yardbirds. In the next couple of years, the Crawdaddy became a London phenomenon, with new venues in Finsbury Park and Croydon. Regular performers included The Who, The Kinks, The Spencer Davis Group, Manfred Mann, The Animals, who moved from Newcastle to join up, The Hoochie Coochie Men, with Rod Stewart on harmonica and vocals, even a very early Fleetwood Mac. But popularity with noisy, disorderly, druggy young people led to unpopularity with the upstanding, peace-and-quiet-loving folks of Richmond. Glowing reviews in the Richmond and Twickenham Times were replaced by irate letters to the editor. The Crown Commissioners, who acted as landlord of the athletic ground on behalf of the Queen, were unhappy and forced the Richmond Club to close. The last gig was on the 25th of July, 1965. I should say, however, that the club has been revived more than once, and we once again have live music once a month or so on the athletic ground. The National Jazz Festival was the third startlingly influential Richmond institution of the moment, and perhaps the one that has survived best. Harold Pendleton was an accountant and the chairman of the National Jazz Federation, and the founder-manager of the Marquee. In 1961, eager to rescue jazz from its image of beatnik alienation, he organized a respectable summer festival in the unimpeachably respectable surroundings of the Richmond Athletic Ground. "We don't want any loincloth and bowler hat types here," said a spokesman. The audience was seated. The toilet facilities functioned. There was paid security and no rhythm and blues. But Alex Korner's Blues Incorporated performed at the second festival, and in August 1963, at the bottom of the bill of the third, were the Rolling Stones, who stole the show. By 1965, the weekend had become the National Jazz and Blues Festival, and 33,000 R&B fans came to Richmond for the weekend. The festival was broadcast live on Radio Luxembourg, and I can understand why. The first night's bill was the Moody Blues, The Who, and the Yardbirds. If you survived until Sunday, you joined John Lennon and George Harrison in the audience and got to hear the Graham Bond Organization, Rod Stewart, Julie Driscoll, the Spencer Davis Group, with the Animals as the final act. And they turned out to be the final act for the festival, too, at least in Richmond. The respectability of 4 years before was long gone, and like Gumelski, Pendleton was told by his hosts that he was no longer welcome. But he was undaunted and moved his festival further west to Windsor, then to Reading, where it survives to this day. These days, it's not as big as Glastonbury, but it is 9 years older and the pioneer of an enormous industry. To end this episode, let me invite you to my favorite movie theater, the Olympic, in Barnes. It's my favorite because before every show, after the trailers, they run a film clip of the Rolling Stones recording Sympathy for the Devil, and they do it because the recording took place in that very room. Hallowed ground. The Olympic was, like Gumelski, another refugee from the West End. Keith Grant opened the original studio in 1961 in a converted synagogue near Baker Street. He and his team were technical wizards. They had the first transistorized recording desk in the world and the first four-track tape deck in England. Some classic tracks were made there, among others, The Troggs' Wild Thing and Dusty Springfield's I Only Want to Be With You. But the building was demolished to make space for a car park, and Grant moved his operation to a derelict building in Barnes. It had already gone through many changes. Built as a theater, it had become a cinema, a theater again. Gielgud and Lawton acted there as young men, a community center. Grant's father, an architect, remodeled the building to his son's specifications, and from 1967 on, everyone who was anyone in rock came to Barnes to record. The Beatles did All You Need Is Love, Hendrix did All Along the Watchtower, Procol Harum did A Whiter Shade of Pale, The Stones, Led Zeppelin, Traffic, Blind Faith, Queen, Prince, all did albums there. The list on the website goes on for miles and miles and miles. Oh yeah, it was recorded there too.
Hi, producer Willem here. After double-checking our script, we realized that we made a slight error. I Can See for Miles and Miles was unfortunately not recorded at the Olympic. Sorry for the interruption, and now back to the show.
The studio was as technically advanced as any in London, perhaps in the world, but the real draw was the people and the atmosphere as much as the gear. Mick Jagger even helped design a second recording space in 1969. As Keith Grant said, you know, Keith Richards would turn up and play on somebody else's record, and Mick Jagger would turn up, and Lennon would turn up and do something. Lennon's Rolls-Royce would often be outside, even though he wasn't working. They used the place as a floating nightclub base. From 1 o'clock in the morning, there could be anybody in there. They just turn up to hang out and then get involved in each other's sessions. The Olympic wasn't just used for rock. Ella Fitzgerald, Tony Bennett, Ray Charles, and Luciano Pavarotti also recorded there, though sadly not all together. Grant had a specialty, film music. The soundtracks of both Jesus Christ Superstar and Life of Brian were created there, as was, of course, the Rocky Horror Picture Show. Abbey Road may be more famous, but the Olympic was just as important to London's musical culture. Virgin Records bought the operation in 1987, and Keith Grant left. Maybe the golden age was over, but I betray my age by neglecting the work done there by U2, Bjork, and Adele, among others. It finally closed in 2009 and reopened as the cinema I love 4 years later. The walls of the lobby and restaurant are still covered with album covers and other reminders of earlier times. The windows of the record store across the street always display albums that were made at the Olympic. Let me finish with a couple of thoughts. One is that rock in Richmond was a very, very male phenomenon. The organizers and the performers were almost exclusively men, and one of the most urgent reasons for its development was that they wanted to attract women. It may have been a musical revolution, but its sexual politics were very, very old-fashioned. This is, of course, reflected in the lyrics of song after song after song. A second is that it was almost completely white. Even though the makers and fans of R&B were conscious of its African-American roots, even though some great African-American musicians played in Richmond, those makers and fans included very few black people. London was vital to the development of reggae, but that was happening elsewhere. A third is that the men I had never heard of until I began research for this episode, Arthur Chisnell, Giorgio Gomelsky, Harold Pendleton, Keith Grant, and others, they were the ones that made it happen. We owe them a lot. A fourth is that it is a real joy to walk almost every day past the place where the Beatles met the Rolling Stones, or where the Yardbirds took their name from a Charlie Parker poster, or where Pete Townsend used to dodge fans while hauling bags of shopping to his home on Richmond Hill. Well, that's enough for now. Thanks for listening. This episode was researched, written, and presented by me, Alan Hertz. Patreon subscribers can find out a bit about the saddest of our borough's rock and roll monuments, the roadside shrine to Mark Bolan, in our latest alleyway. Side Streets is a Black Lab Media production, and my producer and editor is Wilhelm Schenk.